The earth turns into a dandelion clock whose fragile seeds are blown away by a gust of wind. BBC Natural World. A vast golden plain stretching to hazy mountains on the horizon. A man wearing a waistcoat and hat is using a walking stick to steady himself on the uneven and dusty ground. On top of a hill, he pauses to take in the view.
Coming out west to hunt wolves was an impulse thing. I never imagined it would change my life.
The man, much younger now, is riding a horse.
In the autumn of 1893, a man called Ernest Thompson Seton came to New Mexico. These were the dying days of the old Wild West, and Seton's mission was to hunt down the last of the outlaws, the outlaw wolves. But what began as a two-week job turned into an epic duel. A duel that would touch Seton's heart.
Seton's observing two wolves.
And one which, in the end, helped to change forever America's relationship with its wilderness. And it was all because of one remarkable animal.
A grey wolf emerges from the trees at the top of a rocky cliff overlooking the green woodland below. Lobo, the wolf that changed America. Narrated by David Attenborough. David pulls a book out from a bookshelf.
When I was a boy of 10, I was given this book, Wild Animals I Have Known by Ernest Thompson Seton, and it had a huge effect upon me. Seton was a trapper naturalist working on the prairies of North America, and his first story is about Lobo, a wolf that he was hired to trap. And it shows wolves to be brave, fearless, touchingly loyal to one another. I've never forgotten it.
He closes the book. The sun slowly begins to rise from behind a mountain, transforming the clouds from a deep gold into a bright yellow. A herd of deer are grazing on the prairie.
The stage for the drama could hardly be wider or more epic. New Mexico, in the American Southwest, is a land where the rolling prairies meet the foothills of the Rockies.
Snow-capped mountains.
By 1893, the year Seton came to hunt wolves, this was a land being swept by profound change.
Grainy black and white film of a steam locomotive.
The modern world was steaming in. Settlers were arriving by the trainload.
A map of New Mexico.
What had recently been the land of the Apache and the buffalo was now the land of opportunity. Livestock were pouring in. Ranching was big business.
Archive footage of men on horseback driving a herd of cattle.
But the Old West hadn't completely disappeared. Parts of northern New Mexico were still untamed. In the remote Corumpa Valley, wild wolves still roamed the canyons. A vicious war was underway to exterminate the last of these cattle killers.
A wolf's crouching in long grass, watching a herd of cows.
One of these wolves, however, seemed to possess an almost supernatural ability to cheat death.
A cowboy protecting his herd fires a rifle at the wolf, but narrowly misses. The wolf scampers away as the bullets ricochet off the ground.
Seton soon heard about this super wolf from the cowboys. He was known as Lobo, king of the Corumpa. Lobo and his band of outlaws were blamed for killing hundreds of cattle. And, not surprisingly, the cattle barons and their cowboys wanted him dead.
A lone rider holding a rifle.
In many ways, Seton was the perfect assassin. He'd hunted wolves for bounty money before,
and written a manual for his fellow trappers on how to catch them.
The wolf, Lobo, sees Seaton approaching and growls viciously.
He even claimed that one of his Scottish ancestors had wiped out the last remaining wolves in the British Isles. But behind the gun lay a more complex character. Seaton was a naturalist who had grown up in the backwoods of Canada with a real love and fascination for nature. He was also an artist, trained in Paris and London, whose favourite subjects were the wild animals of North America.
Whilst leaning against a mound of earth, Seaton observes a deer through a telescope, then makes a pencil sketch of the animal.
The story of the hunt for Lobo is the story of a divided man. On the one hand, a romantic whose heart was with the wilderness and its wild creatures.
A flock of birds pass over Seaton.
And on the other, a hard hunter who, like the cowboys, saw wolves as somehow different from the other animals, as wanton killers that had to be dealt with.
I am to get board and lodging, all expenses and bounty monies, in exchange for which I shall rid the cowboys of their demon wolf.
He enters a small timber lodge.
I think 2 weeks should be enough to catch the pest.
He unbuckles his holster and bullet belt, then slams a knife into the table. He tips out a box of spare bullets and loads one into his rifle, then sits at the table with a book.
Little did Seaton know the remarkable wolf he was up against. The wild and romantic story that follows is based entirely on the journal that Seaton kept at the time and the book he subsequently wrote. It is, according to Seaton, almost completely true.
He's writing by candlelight.
The animals, he later wrote, were real characters who lived the lives I have depicted. And yet Seaton made such surprising, almost heroic claims about Lobo and his pack that we're bound to wonder how much of it we can really believe.
Lobo's howling at the sky.
A dread of this Lobo has spread among the ranchmen. And now the price set on his head is $1,000, a record bounty for a wolf. He is my number one target.
Wearing a pair of gloves, Seaton removes a small glass bottle from a box.
Seaton had come to New Mexico equipped to wage a poison campaign, a tried and tested method from his wolf hunting days in Canada.
A piece of meat laced with a few drops of strychnine makes a good wolf bait. The poison causes violent spasms, and the victim soon dies of asphyxiation. But it's crucial that the bait is free from the taint of metal or any trace of human scent, or the wolf will get suspicious and avoid it.
Riding across the open plain, he drops the tainted meat on the ground.
It was late October. Seaton set about laying his first baits.
Shadows of clouds race over the parched landscape.
Over the following days, he made a series of wide circuits around the plains, dropping a piece of poisoned meat every so often, taking care not to touch them with his hands or to get off his horse.
He's silhouetted by the sun.
Seaton, the man who had written the textbook on how to catch a wolf, was confident that his expertly prepared baits would soon bring him his $1,000 bounty.
The black shape of Seaton on horseback passes across the evening sky. Night falls, and a full moon casts an eerie glow over the mountains. Sunrise, and a herd of deer are feeding on the brown grass.
Alongside his hunt for Lobo, Seaton also pursued his love of nature, taking every chance to learn more about the wild inhabitants of the Karumpaw.
At first, this place seemed uninviting compared to the lush prairies of Manitoba. But the more I explore, the more I realize it's a paradise. Every spiny bush is teeming with life, and every day I make new friends and learn new facts.
He looks through his telescope.
I was amazed to see the prairie chicken still dancing in the fall.
The bird jerks its head.
Provided they're fat and fit, they seem to like nothing better than a shimmy.
Seaton's watching with delight as the elaborately feathered chickens shuffle around. Then he notices a rodent standing on its hind legs.
They share the plains with hundreds of prairie dogs. And as far as I can see, these little yap rats never go more than 100 yards from home. Every burrow's a plunge hole. A sheer drop for rapid escape.
A bird of prey circling overhead causes a coterie of prairie dogs to disappear into their burrow.
Seaton, a naturalist, may have been cramming his notebooks with observations, but his hunt for Lobo was about to suffer a humiliating setback.
November 3rd. I set out in the afternoon to check my baits and soon picked up Lobo's tracks.
He dismounts.
His monstrous paw print is unmistakable. It measures over 5 inches from claw to heel, which must put him at around 150 pounds.
He checks the horizon, then continues to ride on.
Further ahead, I found that Lobo had come to one of my baits, sniffed at it, and then picked it up. I galloped on with eager eyes, expecting to find him dead within a mile. A second bait had been taken, and then a third. But though I scanned the brush, I saw nothing that looked like a dead wolf. At the fourth bait, I discovered that Lobo hadn't really taken my baits at all, but had merely carried them in his mouth. Then, having piled the three baits on top of the fourth, he'd scattered filth over them to express his utter contempt for my devices.
Seaton looks bemused.
Descriptions like this seem far-fetched. Just how clever are wolves? Could Lobo really have played a joke on Seaton? Since Seaton's time, we've learnt a lot more about wolf behaviour. Today, Yellowstone National Park supports a thriving population of wild wolves, which are closely monitored by scientists. With over 20 years' experience of tracking and studying wolves, Doug Smith is one of the world's leading experts and uniquely qualified to assess what Seaton wrote.
Seaton was imputing these powers of ridicule to the wolves that really are beyond them. Wolves really don't care about us, but it's well known among wolf biologists that when you trap and catch wolves a lot, they get educated. You teach them how to avoid you catching them. The wolves that were left were getting educated by the traps and the guns and the poison that people were using to kill them. And so what Seaton encountered in some ways was the best of the best.
Lobo's baring his fangs and staring with piercing intensity. Water's trickling beneath a layer of thin ice, and Seaton's riding across snow-covered hills.
Seaton had come to New Mexico as a hired gun to do a dirty job, expecting to stay for a couple of weeks. But Lobo continued to elude him, and as the weeks stretched into months, the untamed beauty of the land began to cast its spell. He was falling in love with the West.
He's gazing out across the spectacular landscape.
He was also learning of the old days, when the wild game abounded and the wilderness was unspoiled.
I can usually reckon on seeing a dozen or more pronghorn on the plains. Everyone says that these bands are nothing compared with the huge herds of days gone by. This land is vast, but beyond these horizons, America is busy growing like an ugly, overfed brat. Too healthy to slow down, too young and ambitious to care about what it destroys along the way.
In the Karumpo, Seaton had plenty of time to think about America's dwindling wildlife. Only a few years earlier, there had still been buffalo on the plains.
One of the cowboys saw a small herd not far from here in 88, just 5 winters back. These would have been the very last survivors in the entire Southwest.
A herd of buffalo grazing in a snowstorm.
For tens of thousands of years, wolves had survived by hunting one of North America's most formidable prey species.
The buffalo stampede.
They'd pitted their wits against the sheer size and ferocity of the buffalo. This required teamwork. It was little wonder that wolves had evolved into such highly intelligent animals with intimate family bonds. After the buffalo, a cow was a piece of cake.
The wolf problem clearly is something that we have created. First, we annihilated the great herds of buffalo that the wolves depended on for food. Then we filled the prairies with our defenseless cattle. I am told that Lobo's band alone kills a cow every day.
A herd of cows spook and charge, pursued by a pack of wolves.
Lobo's pack could slice through livestock like a knife through butter.
Wolves probably could have killed as much livestock as Seton described. The livestock was vulnerable and helpless. We bred their natural defenses out of them. And wolves are intelligent, and they had figured that out. And so wolves have a mentality, really, of kill everything you can.
Seton still had the job to do. And after the failure of his poison baits, he now brought out a new weapon. The double spring steel wolf trap. Perhaps a more muscular approach would defeat the wily Lobo.
A cowboy.
Darren Brown lives today just a few miles north of the Corumpaw on a ranch where Seton is known to have stayed. In fact, some of Seton's actual traps were left here with Darren's grandfather in this very barn.
Number 4.5, wolf trap. This is one of the actual traps that Seton used to try to catch Lobo.
These traps are designed to grab and hold their victims rather than kill them.
I'm going to put some soft dirt in here so the trap will set just right.
He places the trap.
And all the time, keep in mind, this is a real trap. It'd catch me as well as any animal. The wolf will actually put his foot on this is what triggers it to go off. Now, I want to keep an open area under the trap pan so that when the animal steps on it, it'll actually spring the trap. If you had dirt underneath it, it wouldn't go off. It'd just sit there. And a real key element is to make this about as natural with the ground around it as you can.
He buries it.
Okay. Nothing exposed. Now we have the trap set. Though it's over 100 years old, it still functions perfectly.
Darren presses on the soil with a stick, and the trap slams shut around it, throwing a shower of mud into the air.
It's just designed to catch it and still get blood circulation to their foot. This is also hooked to a drag. As it goes along the ground, it'll get caught in a cactus or a tree or anything along the way. It slows them up enough, it leaves a mark on the ground, and then you can follow the animal.
Seton and another man are laying traps and dragging wolf skins across the ground wherever they step.
December 13th. This afternoon, I went up the West Canyon with rancher Bill Allen, and we put out a dozen traps along one of Lobo's trails, always taking care to cover our scent and tracks.
Catching Lobo was becoming an obsession. Seton simply didn't see wolves the way he saw other wild creatures. Unlike wolves, which were killers, animals like elk didn't threaten anyone's livelihood. On the contrary, like the buffalo and the pronghorn, elk were now themselves in decline, the victims of overhunting by man. Seton's love affair with New Mexico was deepening by the day. In fact, his concern for all of North America's wildlife was very likely awakening. But when it came to wolves, Seton was still thinking in the old way. Throughout history, we've demonized wolves, seen them as wanton, bloodthirsty killers, almost the embodiment of evil.
Two wolves snarling over a cow's carcass.
Thursday, December 14th. I rode out to check my traps and soon came upon Lobo's trail. In the dust, I could read the whole story of his doings the previous night. He'd run along through the scrub for a few hundred yards, then turned towards my traps. But upon reaching the first one, he'd scratched up stones and earth till he'd sprung the trap and made it safe.
Continuing along the trail, Seton discovered that Lobo had disarmed over a dozen of his traps in the same way. How could he have seen through Seton's clever plan so easily?
Wolves are very, very observant of their environment. They pay attention to a degree that people have a hard time fathoming. They're just extremely attentive to every little thing in their environment. They knew Seton was after him and his other cowboys. And so they became very attuned to his tricks. And once they learn about traps, about steel, they become hyper-observant. That's all they're doing.
The wily wolf had outwitted Seton once again. It was going to be a long winter.
Seton's riding through a harsh snowstorm, which is lashing the countryside with ice and wind.
Week after week, I vary my methods and redouble my precautions, yet there is only defeat after defeat. The cowboys complain bitterly of their losses, and each night old Lobo mocks me with his triumphant howl. December 24th, went in the afternoon to trail wolves. Saw only coyotes and jackrabbits. Wolves have killed three cattle and a colt. Damn, Christmas Day, 1893. Found many wolf tracks today, but caught nothing. January 5th, bitterly cold. Dates untouched. January 13th, got nothing and saw nothing. Today I have ridden without rest or stop, between 35 and 40 miles. I am facing total humiliation.
The sun rises over a lake, swarming with geese and cranes. Seton slowly stirs from his sleep.
After months of failure, Seton must have been at his wit's end. He hadn't even clapped eyes on Lobo. What he desperately needed was a lucky break.
Lobo's at the water's edge.
And eventually, that's exactly what he got.
I camped out above the creek, close to where the snow geese and cranes are wintering. They spend the nights huddled together in the marsh, beyond the reach of the coyotes and the wolves.
Lobo and his pack's sudden movements spark a chain reaction of panic amongst the birds, and they take flight with an excited jolt. Seton reacts to the noise, extinguishes his campfire, and watches the avian cloud drift overhead. He mounts his horse.
It was the commotion of the geese that led me to the clue I so badly needed.
At a small stream, Seton dismounts and ties his horse, then approaches a boggy patch of mud marked with some paw prints. One set of prints is distinctly bigger than the other.
I recognized Lobo's mark instantly, and then noticed a second set of tracks, always, it seemed, running out in front. Wherever these smaller tracks led, old Lobo was sure to follow, leaping and rolling in the mud.
Lobo and another wolf leap across streams, and Seton follows their tracks.
Suddenly, I realized what was going on.
Seton rolls like Lobo.
The old marauder was in love.
Lobo and the snow-white female chase each other and play fight in the wet marshland. Thank you.
Seaton knew immediately that the she-wolf was his big chance. A cynical new plan formed in his mind.
During the breeding season, which apparently a lot of his story took place, that male's tending that female extremely closely. He rarely leaves her side during that time period. I chase wolves with a helicopter. It doesn't hurt them, we have to do it. But when we move in on them, it's during the mating season, and you can always tell who's the breeding pair, because they will not separate. And so they're moving around in their own little orbit of two, and the rest of the pack breaks up and goes every which way. That male wolf, the alpha male, sticks right with that female.
Seaton and the rancher Bill are digging holes to place traps.
I soon learned more about Lobo's mate from the shepherds. They call her Blanca because of her white coat, and they say she leads Lobo a merry dance. This tallies with the tracks I saw at the creek, and has suggested a way to catch her.
Let's see if that's right side. That's good. Right there.
Cunningly, Seaton first placed traps rather obviously around a dead cow, guessing that Lobo would stop and try to disarm them. While he was thus diverted, Seaton hoped that Lobo's mate, Blanca, would run on to investigate the head of the cow, which Seaton had cut off and put to one side. It could only be approached through a narrow passage between rocks, and it was here that Seaton planted several of his best traps, properly deodorized and concealed with the utmost care.
After burying the traps, they drag a wolf skin over the ground. Birds are circling in the sky above, and as the evening draws to a close, clouds over the mountains reflect the warm orange glow of the setting sun.
Wednesday, January 24th. This evening I am more excited and yet more anxious than I have been in 3 long months. Try as I might, I cannot get to sleep.
Seaton tosses and turns in his bed, whilst outside the female wolf, Blanca, approaches the cow carcass. She edges closer to the dead animal with tentative steps. She growls softly and sniffs the ground. A loose stone makes her body tense, but she advances towards the cow's head. She paws at the loose soil. She takes another step forward. A trap springs from the ground and clamps shut around Blanca's leg. As she struggles to crawl away, the chain anchor lodges itself between some rocks. Seaton sits up in his bed, alerted by the noise. Lobo comes to her and remains at her side as she writhes around in agony. Dawn arrives.
The following morning, Seaton went up the canyon, hoping that at last he had struck a blow against Lobo. He was in luck. Blanca had walked right into his trap.
She tries to escape, but the anchor hooks onto a rock.
According to Seaton, Lobo remained close by, reluctant to leave his mate.
Blanca snarls.
But it would have been suicide to stay and face the men's guns.
Lobo flees.
Seaton would later recoil from what he called the inevitable tragedy that followed. But the plain fact is, he was here to do a job. He was here to kill wolves.
Seaton aims at Blanca and fires. Lobo watches from a clifftop as Seaton rides away with Blanca's white body slumped over his horse. Bill's riding closely behind them.
Success at last. Seaton had claimed his first scalp. And yet now, with Blanca dead, Lobo was about to touch Seaton's heart and change forever the way he saw wolves. The king of the Kurumpa had lost his mate.
Evening. and Seaton's writing in his journal by candlelight when a sound distracts him. He listens to the howling.
Tonight I heard Lobo up in the canyon, and there was an unmistakable note of sorrow in his voice. It was no longer the loud, defiant howl I had heard so often, but a long, plaintive wail. Blanca! Blanca! He seemed to call. It was sadder than I could possibly have imagined.
I think there is an emotional attachment between wolves in a pack, certainly among a mated pair. And the example I use is here in Yellowstone, a wolf died, a female wolf. She was the alpha, very similar to Blanca. She was killed by another pack, and the alpha male, pardon my way of putting it, seemed to mourn. He howled for 2 days after, more than anybody had seen him howl. And he wailed and he wailed and he wailed. A little bit of what Seaton described in his story, we've seen here in the wilds of Yellowstone.
Seaton had brought Blanca's body back to his cabin, but the last thing he expected was for Lobo to throw caution to the wind and come looking for her.
Seaton's sitting at the table in his lodge, having a drink, and Lobo's slender body drifts in and out of view through the gaps in the wooden walls. Seaton's alerted by the noise and reaches for his rifle. Lobo's sniffing around outside the lodge. Holding his lantern in one hand, his rifle in the other, Seaton opens his door and fires, but Lobo runs away unscathed.
Not once has he shown himself in all the months I've pursued him. Yet now he scorns his own safety to find his beloved Blanca.
We can only guess what doubts were creeping into Seaton's mind. But it was too late to stop now.
Daylight, and Seaton's placing more traps.
Seaton had to strike fast while Lobo's guard was down. He gathered in all his traps, 130 in all, and set them on every approach to his cabin. Last of all, he used Blanca's scent as a lure to draw Lobo in.
He's dragging Blanca's body along the ground behind his horse.
Seaton set out the next morning with confidence. Every outlaw tale has its showdown. And for Seaton and Lobo, the fateful day was January the 31st, 1894.
Bill and Seaton emerge from the woods and ride across an open area. Lobo's grey eyes watch Seaton as he dismounts from his horse.
His plan had worked.
Seaton cautiously approaches Lobo, who's lying on the dusty ground, and takes a camera out from his coat pocket.
The first thing Seaton did was take a photograph. It's an astonishing record that survives to this day. Old Lobo, the king of the Corumpo, is clearly visible, caught in four traps, one on each leg. That's what it had taken to stop this incredible wolf.
Seaton gently pulls his rifle from out of his holster, attached to his horse's saddle, walks up to Lobo and aims.
Seaton had won. After the long chase, he finally had Lobo at his mercy.
He stares down the barrel of his rifle into Lobo's eyes.
But face to face with his adversary, Seaton's resolve faltered.
He lowers his rifle.
Perhaps killing Lobo no longer felt like a victory, but a crime. Perhaps, in his eyes, Lobo was no longer vermin, but a creature with dignity, courageous, loyal, and loving.
Blanca and Lobo standing side by side in the snow.
Until now, Seton had seen wolves simply as indiscriminate killers. But they were obviously much more than that. They were the very embodiment of America's vanishing wilderness.
Seton raises his rifle once more, takes aim, but lowers it again.
It's as if the conflict within Seton, between the hunter and the naturalist, was finally resolved. He decided to take Lobo back alive.
He holsters the weapon.
Sadly, it was too late.
Lobo made no resistance to me. He never once looked at me, but acted as though he was alone on the plains.
Seton's watching the tied-up Lobo and gently taps on his holstered pistol.
His eyes were fixed on the far rolling mesas, his passing kingdom, where his famous band was now scattered. When the sun went down, he was still gazing out across the prairie. But within a few hours, the old King Wolf was dead. We know that an eagle robbed of his freedom, a lion shorn of his strength, a dove bereft of his mate, all die, it is said, of a broken heart. And so it was with old Lobo, the king of the Karumpa.
It was Lobo's loyalty to Blanca that had been his downfall. And now Seton took Lobo to be with her again.
Seton and Bill carry Lobo's body into a barn and place him on the straw-covered ground beside Blanca.
Seton profoundly regretted what he had done. He never killed another wolf.
When I read Seton's story, to a certain degree, I filtered through a lot of his flowery language. I looked at it through a biological lens, is what these wolves were doing, given the context of the time, which was no to little natural prey, a laser focus on killing livestock, an incredible ability to avoid traps and guns and poisons. Is all that possible? Absolutely. Do wolves have an incredibly strong attachment between a mated pair? Absolutely.
Seton's riding with Lobo's body draped over his horse.
Lobo, the last outlaw wolf of New Mexico, was dead. The Karumpa Valley had been silenced. It was job done. By 1894, it seemed that virtually all of America's wilderness was destined to be cleaned up, civilized, and made safe.
He's riding out across the rugged land.
Seton had come here in the twilight years of the Wild West, just as the sun was setting on a magnificent, untamed world. And he had played his part in its destruction. If we're inclined to judge Seton harshly, we should remember that in the 1890s, wolves were cattle killers and could ruin the livelihood of the pioneer ranchers and the cowboys. But that was not the end of Lobo's impact on the world of men. In fact, it was just the beginning. What happened next to Seton and the story he wrote about Lobo would have a profound effect on the relationship between Americans and their wilderness.
An old black and white film of a steam train arriving in Pennsylvania.
Seton returned east, deeply affected by his western adventure, and determined to record what had happened. In the story he wrote, he boldly cast himself as the villain and the wolf as the hero. His book, Wild Animals I Have Known, was an immediate worldwide hit. Virtually overnight, it propelled Seton from a little-known naturalist into a major celebrity. But what really mattered to Seton now was saving America's wilderness before it was too late. Historian David Witt thinks the turning point can be traced back to a single word in Seton's journal.
He has this last word in the entry, why. And it was a very big why. It was even written in large letters. I thought maybe he was putting down that why, asking why did the animal die, because he follows up with a couple of notes about the physical condition of the animal. But I think that the why was much bigger than that. It really was a why asking, why are we doing this? What is our relationship to nature? Why are we destroying it like this?
At a time when few people questioned the destruction of nature, Seton spoke up for the wilderness. His views about the value of the wild found favor with politicians like Teddy Roosevelt and helped to turn the tide of public opinion. Seton used his influence to push for the creation of more national parks. Thousands of ordinary Americans became aware of their spectacular natural heritage.
A road carved through a tree trunk.
So Seton took a leading role in what became the conservation movement and eventually the environmental movement. He was talking about our relationship not only to animals, but to all of nature. He was doing it in a very ecological way. He was certainly one of the first ecologists.
Seton also lobbied for hunting restrictions and anti-poaching measures and was instrumental in pushing through radical new laws to protect migrating birds.
He did lobby for environmental legislation, including the first wildlife legislation that protected migratory animals. And because of Seton, they lobbied Congress and expanded federal government authority to the interstate control of wildlife. It was a major increase in federal government authority, and it laid the groundwork for every single piece of environmental legislation that has come after that time.
And it wasn't just a question of saving the wilderness. Seton felt that people had to experience it in order to care about it, that it should be a part of everyone's upbringing. Inspired by the values of Native American culture, he founded the Woodcraft Indians, an organization that taught children many of the skills needed for outdoor life, along with a respect for nature. Many of these ideas were later adopted as the basis for the Boy Scouts in England, and Seton himself was a founding father of the Boy Scouts of America. By the early years of the 20th century, the United States led the world in the conservation of nature, and tens of thousands of children were heading off to camp in the woods and the mountains.
Boy Scouts hiking.
Seton had been a prime mover in all of this, and it had all started back in the Kurumpo in the autumn of 1893, when he had set out to kill an outlaw wolf called Lobo.
A pack of wolves in the snow.
But what about wolves? Was the new nature-loving America ready to embrace its old enemy? For decades, Seton was virtually alone in his desire to protect wolves alongside the other wild animals. It's taken a long time for the rest of America to catch up. As head of the Wolf Reintroduction Program in Yellowstone, Doug Smith sees his job as trying to complete what Seton began.
The change of heart to wolves has only been going for about 30 or 40 years. I mean, literally, in the United States, in the 1960s, most people still thought wolves were bad. And I think what we had is an awakening to a new environmental movement, and that killing all these predators, wolves and other carnivores, without question for so long, I think the light bulb went on in people's heads as, is why? But I need to be very clear, there is still a large group of people who retain the old view of wolves. I know people who have come up to me and said, my grandfather killed off this animal to make life here easier, and you're bringing it back. So attitudes have changed, but the old attitudes still exist. And so now we're at this very polarized bashing of heads about how to live in this world. Because some people feel predators like wolves have no place still, as many people felt in Seton's time. But others are saying, hey, we made a mistake, and we need to bring wolves back.
the packs crossing the frozen prairie.
Seton has had a tremendous impact on where we are today in terms of respecting nature. And I think enough people, at least in North America, Canadians and Americans, recognize that we have maybe overstretched our reach in terms of what we've taken.
Like many a good tale from the Wild West, Lobo's story is a mixture of myth and truth. On the one hand, we know that Seton could exaggerate. The reward on Lobo's head was not $1,000, but a mere 12. And we know from Seton's diary that Lobo was not a monster of 150 pounds, but an average-sized wolf. On the other hand, there's a lot of truth in the story. Many of the traps that Seton used are still there in New Mexico. There's Seton's photograph of Lobo in one of those traps. And we have this. It's the skull of one of the wolves that Seton killed, with Seton's own label still attached. And the museum that owns it thinks it may well be the skull of Blanca.
Blanca's trotting through the snow.
Whatever the truth, the important thing about this story is that it depicted wolves in a more realistic and more sympathetic way than anything that had been written before. The duel between Seton and Lobo may have ended in sad deaths, but it also breathed new life into the Americans' appreciation of the wilderness. In later life, Seton returned to live in his beloved New Mexico.
I have been much criticized, firstly for killing Blanca and Lobo, but chiefly for telling of it to the distress of many tender hearts. To this I reply, in what frame of mind are my readers left with regard to the wolf? Are their sympathies quickened toward the man who killed him, or toward the noble creature who died as he lived, dignified, fearless, and steadfast?
Right up to his death in 1946, Seton continued to reflect on the wolf that changed his life.
Ever since Lobo, my sincerest wish has been to impress upon people that each of our native wild creatures is in itself a precious heritage that we have no right to destroy or put beyond the reach of our children.